Working Cows Podcast, Episode 121.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. Happy New Year. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And today we are joined by Gabe Brown. Really excited to sit down with Gabe again. Had him on episode 67. That'll be linked at the show notes page for today. WorkingCows.net/121 if you want to go back and catch that episode where we talked about his book, Dirt to Soil. And Gabe is, as Steve Kenyon described him, a rock star of regenerative agriculture. And we're going to talk to him about some of his recent talk that he gave at the Western Canadian Soil Health Coalition. And really excited to have Gabe on the show again today. Gabe, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast. Welcome back.
My pleasure.
Well, I was scrolling through social media somewhere the other day, and I saw a quote from you at the, I think it was the Western Canadian Soil Health Conference, and you said that, or you were quoted as saying that if you're getting greater than 60% conception rates, you are supplementing too much. And so I kind of figured that was a heifer development context, and reached out to you and verified that, and then asked if we could sit down and talk a little bit about what you guys are doing at Brown's Ranch for heifer development. So, first of all, is that an accurate understanding of what you were saying there in the Western Canadian Soil Health Conference?
It is. Realize I'm serious when I say that about our own ranch, but as I always am sure to tell everyone that what you do on your own farm or ranch is up to you. But my whole point is to get the people thinking of how do we make more money in this cattle business? Well, I firmly believe that the key to profit is utilizing the forages that you have available on your own ranch. Now, that's going to be different, obviously, wherever you ranch. So you can't copy exactly what I'm doing near Bismarck, North Dakota, but the concepts are the same. You know, the greatest expense, obviously, in running a cow for the year is that winter feed cost. And so how do we lower that cost? Obviously, the longer we can graze an animal, the better. But I really think that the majority of producers are missing a real opportunity by not taking advantage of epigenetics. And Dr. Fred Provenza, retired professor at Utah State University, has done a lot of work with epigenetics. And that's the ability of more or less fetal programming, so to speak. It's the ability of that calf, when it's in utero, to pick up the ability to utilize, for instance, lower quality forages, and to be able to be more efficient if consuming those lower quality forages. So what Dr. Provenza, through his research, found was, and he worked primarily with sheep, but the same holds true for cattle or any species for that matter, is that he fed a group of ewes a quote-unquote balanced ration, then fed a group of ewes a lower quality, lower nutrient-dense ration consisting primarily of straw. And then he followed the offspring that those ewes were carrying in them at the time through their life cycle, and he found that the ewe lambs that were born from the ewes fed the lower quality ration were able to consume, digest, and do better on lower quality feedstuffs. So if we take that to the cattle side of things, and what we're trying to do specifically on our ranch is we winter our cows. Like right now, we just had another storm go through, and we probably got a good 2 feet of snow on the level right now, and it's back pretty hard because we had several days of sustained 40-mile-an-hour winds. But our cows are still out there grazing through that with calves at their side. And what we found, we're about approximately 12 years into this process of changing the way we see things and changing our management. And we have found that every year by doing that, we now have, as these heifers calve and come into program, because we raise all our own replacements, that they're much more efficient. We're getting through the winter on much less feed costs. We do, because of the fact that we're not contiguous here, and, you know, I farm more or less almost in the city here. Our ranch is in the jurisdiction city of Bismarck, so there's housing developments around us. So I run out of grazing, and we usually end up bale grazing about 40 to 60 days a winter. But even at that, those animals are consuming much less forage than they used to. So getting back to your original question on getting 60% breed up on the heifers, what we found is the more we can, quote-unquote, challenge our heifers, so in other words, we leave them on the cow and we don't wean them until April, and then they go right out on grass, stockpiled forage. You know, early April here in North Dakota, there's not much green up, so they're mainly consuming very dry, low-quality stockpiled forage. That is challenging them. And so what we found, if we feed them better quality, maybe bale graze them longer, et cetera, we're kind of spoiling them, and we're not taking advantage of this epigenetics and challenging them. So by challenging them and getting, you know, it's been running in the 50 to 60% breed up, and realize it's getting a few more bred every year, so we challenge them a little harder every year. It's kind of a game we play. and the reason for that is we only want the most fertile, efficient cows, you know, heifers, excuse me, to get bred. And what we find, you know, with many ranches, the big challenge is getting the wet twos to cycle and rebreed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have much of a challenge of that, because if we challenge them enough as a heifer, we're finding they're going to stay in the herd much, much longer. And they're able to breed back as wet twos and continue that breed back for the rest of their lives. And so it's just a different thought process. And I tell people, I remember that back when I was in the registered business and we were breeding every year 50 to 75 heifers, I remember one period I went 3 years in a row without a single heifer not settling, you know, and they were all bred. And I think back and I just shake my head, boy, Gabe, that made no sense at all, you know. And so it's a different mindset. And I make that bold statement, as I said, just to get people thinking and to spur the conversation, and I'm glad that it piqued your interest there.
Yeah. So I guess where I'd like to start then for today is, could you give us a layout of the life cycle of a calf and a cow on your ranch, as far as when are they born? You said they're staying on the cow till April. And then where do they go from there? What happens if they fall out of the breeding program, as it kind of sounds like you hope they do, prove that they're not fit to survive in your environment? So could you lay that out for us?
Sure. So realize back when I was in the registered business, I started calving heifers late January and then cows in February. And that tells you how unintelligent Gabe Brown really is to be doing that here in North Dakota. You know, and we, back in 2009, we made the switch. We went from registered cattle calving early to quote unquote commercial cattle. They were the same cows. We didn't sell our cow herd. We just took the cow herd we had, and we bred them to start calving May 1st for a 60-day season. But that first year, we had a snowstorm the first weekend in May. And I told my son we're still calving too early, so we switched to May 15th. And that's where we've been since then. We start calving May 15th. We run bulls with the cows for 45 days, so we're done the last week of June. Okay, those calves then stay on those cows, as I said, all winter. And we're still maybe fine-tuning that a little bit. We've been weaning anywhere from April 1st to April 20th, and we're not quite sure where the sweet spot is. That's kind of dependent on weather there. Those calves then, well, let me start with the cows. We do not pregnancy test our cow herd. And the reason is, if we pregnancy test the cows, say back in December, because we're turning bulls out August 5th for 45 days, and then if you wait a little bit, PGM, if we pregnancy test those cows in December, what am I going to do with the open cows? Am I going to wean that handful of calves and have them standing in a corral? No. We leave them on the cows. We don't pregnancy test. Leave them on the cows. Those cows then, we wean the calves off them in early April. Well, what happens when you kick a dry cow out on spring green up? You know, she gets looking like me. She blows up, gets hog fat, and so what we do then is the last week of calving, the end of June, whatever paddock the cows are in, we go set up panels and we walk the cows and calves through. Any cow that's dry, which means she was either open or she lost her calf at calving. And we calve, you know, 2 miles from the nearest corral. We, you know, if our cows have a problem, they better figure it out, you know. We pull those off. So anything that's dry, we pull off. When's the hot hamburger market? When's your highest prices for a hamburger?
July 4th.
Yep. So we take them right to the kill plant. They get processed, made into burger. Boom. You know, that's just, it saves us all the work and effort of pregnancy testing. And people might say, yeah, but you got to feed that cow. Well, she's got a calf on her. And so that calf then is, you know, being supplemented a little bit by nursing on that cow. Okay, so that's the first step, the cow. Now, the calves, what we do with them is after we wean them, and we fence line wean them just with a hot wire, works extremely well, and the cows have to walk a ways to graze, so they don't spend much time worrying about the calf. They're going to want to graze after a day. And so we wean those calves, then the calves go out on stockpiled forage. And what I mean by that, it's primarily native rangeland that was not grazed the previous year. We're grazing our paddocks, coming around our paddocks, grazing them about once every 12 to 14 months. And so it has adequate time to recover and build that soil health and that healthy plant. And so those calves will go out on a paddock that was not grazed the previous year. So they're eating primarily that old, you know, stockpiled forage, but those are the paddocks that will start growth quickest in the spring. And so they're getting a little bit of green as soon as the snow leaves and it starts to green up. Then they'll go through the rotation on the native rangeland for that summer. And we like to use our heifers kind of as a landscaping tool. So, for instance, if we got a paddock that we think is getting, for instance, I'll just use it as an example, a little too much of a buckbrush, western snowberry built up in it, we'll use the heifers to go in and graze that paddock, higher stock density, and, you know, we're not concerned about getting them, quote unquote, the optimum nutrition from forage. You know, they need to make do on what we're providing. Or here on our ranch, we lease land that was in the Conservation Reserve Program for 20 years. Well, after 20 years in CRP in North Dakota, you have smooth bone grass and Canada thistle. And that's what it is. So we'll take those heifers and graze paddocks like that in order to graze that Canada thistle and stimulate other species to grow in there, stimulate that latent seed bank. So come August 5th, we turn the bulls out with the heifers, same day we do the cows. And I should mention, usually our steers are grazing with the heifers at that time. Come August 5th, we will separate the steers from the heifers, and then we just dump a bunch of home-raised bulls out with those heifers for 30 days. After 30 days, we pull those bulls. Come December, now those cattle are still grazing that quote-unquote native range, expired CRP, etc. Come December, we will ultrasound those heifers. Everything that's bred, we have the option of either putting into our own herd or we sell as bred heifers. And everything that's open, they go on to be grass finished. And so we do split any we want to keep into our own herd. They go right up after we ultrasound them. They go right in with the cow herd. And so those heifers, the only time they're ever run through a chute in their life is when we ultrasound them. And at that time, if they're bred, they get branded and they get a second ear tag put in them. And that's it. And so we found that it's the less we can work with our animals, so to speak, put them through a chute, put vaccines, forons on them, wormers, etc., the more profitable we are. And people say, yeah, but some of your cattle probably have worms. Well, they'll fall out of the herd. If they have worms, there are not chances they're not going to rebreed. And so then they're not in the herd. Everything that's open always gets sold. And it's a change of mindset. You know, people, they want this high breed up so they have the most calves to sell. Well, realize that the cows are also income, if the open cows. They become income also. Now, one of the benefits we have in our ranch is that we're direct marketing all this grass-finished beef. So if we do have a young cow, age 5 or under, come up open, we're able to harvest that animal and sell that as, high-quality beef. Now, if it's an animal older than approximately year 5, that'll go for burger, et cetera. So we add value that way. It's all about capturing value.
Yeah, and it's not like you're sitting on your hands, obviously, with the grass-finished market development. That was a lot of work and took a lot of effort. Do you guys market steers as grass-finished, or are you selling them on a market through the sale barn or something?
Yeah, and I think one of the keys to resiliency on a farm or ranch is adaptability. You have to be able to, your animals have to be able to adapt to the conditions each year according to what they are, you know, whether it be a drier year, wetter year. But also from a profitability standpoint, you have to be able to adapt. So we went through 3 very dry years here in Central North Dakota, 2016, 17, and 18, were very dry. During that time period, you know, the focus has to be on our grass-finished animals and our cow herd, okay? Well, think of what we're doing here. We're calving late May and June. We leave the calves on the cows all winter, and I'm not kidding anybody. Our calves do not put on weight during the winter. You know, they stay alive. That's what they're doing. But who else has lightweight calves to market for grass cattle in early May, okay? Very, very few people. So we're actually seeing, there was here 3 years ago, we saw a 30-cent premium per pound for our lightweight calves. And typically it runs about a 20-cent premium. Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting as much when we sell those steer calves. So I'm talking about our steers, selling them. We were selling them then in early May. We wean them, you know, in early April, and we were just running them on stockpiled forage and then selling them. We were seeing as much, well, actually higher net income doing that than did people who backgrounded them and fed them to heavier weight. And so look at all the extra dollars we're pocketing that. Now, if there is not a big demand for those grass calves in early May, and or if we have the forage for them, then we'll take and run them as yearlings. We have the option to sell them coming off grass in the fall, or we can take them all the way to grass finish. At this time, our direct market beef business, we're not quite able to market all of our animals through that meat business. So the steers are kind of the variable. But that gets us into a whole nother series of questions is, well, how many animals, you know, how many cows should a ranch run? And, you know, I have the good fortune. I work on a lot of farms and ranches all over North America every year consulting. And we typically find that the vast majority, 90%+ of the ranches out there are running too many cows. Mm-hmm. And what we tell them is, how many cows can you run in your worst case drought scenario? That's where your cow herd should be starting out. Now, as we improve soil health and our ability to graze and our management, we can increase that carrying capacity. But starting out, we should only run that amount that we could run in that least productive year, and then use the yearlings, replacement heifers, et cetera, as the variable. By doing that, we find that it's much more profitable for the producer, because we all know how difficult it is to jump in and out of the cow business. Yet it's very, very easy to market calves or yearlings. And so you've got to think of that also.
So I opened up some questions to my private Facebook group and got some really stellar questions. Some of them are fairly detailed, but I'm going to try and distill down what is being said as much as I can into a one- or two-sentence question. So we're going to start off with this one. It says, most of my first calf heifers after switching to grass-based genetics are scarily small, having their first calf at 24 months. Their body condition score is good, but just very small frame, maybe 750 pounds at calving. I now am hearing of people who are calving grass-based genetics, small-framed females for the first time at 3 years of age. Is this acceptable in your mind?
Again, who is Gabe Brown to tell what's acceptable or what isn't? You know, and again, this comes down to the principle of context. You know, each farm or ranch is a little different. So I am not going to tell people not to do that. We do not do that on our operation, and here's why. Now, he mentioned 750 pounds at calving a first calf heifer. I think that's perfect, you know, for my environment. And that's what we're doing here. Our heifers will typically weigh about 750 pounds. When they're calving as 2-year-olds. I think that's perfect. That equates to an 1,100-pound hog fat cow. Well, what's wrong with that? Do the math. Just do the math. 99% of the time, small cows will make you more money. You can run more small cows. Just do the math, the price per pound for the calves, et cetera. You will be making more money. So I don't see anything wrong with that. Now, people might say, yeah, but they're too small for the packer. Well, are they? Our last load taken to kill here in October, they were heifers. They averaged 1,176 pounds live weight. Okay, I don't think that's too small. And, you know, obviously because we're marketing direct, it didn't matter. But we have no problem marketing our cattle into the quote-unquote conventional market. So the thing about what, and I have not tried to do this myself, but I've seen it on a number of operations, by taking them to 3 years old, those, yes, you will get more animals bred. But again, man, are you challenging their genetics? Are you really working on epigenetics? Okay. No, not if you're taking them to three. The other thing is those animals that calve for the first time as a 3-year-old, they will have a larger mature weight, larger, mature weight, you run less, you can run less animals. So do the math. I have not found where that's worked very well, but again, that's up for each individual to decide.
Right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure this individual's in a fairly similar situation to you. He might be a little wetter, but he's in snow country for sure. And the other, he does say it doesn't fit my financial paradigm. So, I mean, it's a struggle that way. It's going to make a tax on him in that way.
I just don't understand, doesn't fit his financial paradigm when, I mean, we've done this math. My business partner, Dr. Alan Williams, has done this math 1,000 times. The small cows are going to make you more money time and time and time again. Yep. So I'm not quite following him there. I challenge him. He's probably thinking is the first few years he's not getting many of those heifers bred.
Right.
And that's down to marketing, et cetera.
Yeah. Sure. His financial paradigm comment, the way I'm taking it, is taking them to three years old doesn't fit his paradigm.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was looking at the other way.
Gotcha. We'll come back around to his final question at the end of this episode because I want to use it as a wrap-up. But I've got two questions that are essentially the same, and that is, can you raise a cow cheaper than you can buy a bred cow? Can you get her into the herd cheaper than you can buy her bred? And some of the you know, like you're talking about, epigenetic considerations there. So I'd like to hear your answer on that, if you don't mind.
Sure. On my own ranch, yes, we can definitely raise it cheaper than we can buy it. But that's because, you know, I expect them to winter on a rock pile. You know, I'm not going to – we just don't – you know, they're eating forage, okay? The challenge is that the genetics – and I get a lot of static, you know, back when I was – the people that I associated with back when I was in the purebred business really give me static for this. Well, you know, we need these. We're breeding optimum genetics, and you need the right genetics. Well, the issue today, I honestly believe, is 95%+ of the cattle in the United States just cannot thrive, truly thrive in their environment. And I'll just give you this for an example. I just did a few weeks in Texas, and there's guys down there feeding hay 6 months out of the year, you know, and they're supplementing. They said, oh, our forage quality is so poor, we have to. And I said, come to North Dakota and let your cattle graze through 2 feet of snow, you know, and see what forage quality they can live on. You know, my point being, we're supplementing these cattle. And we've got to remove these crutches and challenge the cattle. Well, when you're buying your replacements, where have they been raised? What have they been raised on? Chances are the people that are raising those replacements, they want to get as many bred as possible. They're supplementing them. Is that what you're going to do on your ranch? Yet you expect those cows to thrive in your environment? Good luck.
Yeah, very. I agree with that. I've got a couple of questions that are similar, and you've kind of answered them a little bit so far, but basically the age of the heifers when you're turning the bull out and the size when you're turning the bull out. We had an episode way back, episode 11 of the Working Cows podcast. It was about heifer development, and it was Trey Patterson with some research about developing them to a lower percentage of mature body weight for first-time breeding. Can you just talk about some of the advantages of the way that you're doing it with regard to their age and their size the first time they're encountering a bull?
Sure, and realize that this is just from what I've seen on my own ranch and on the ranches that we've consulted on, is as you move down this path, you definitely will be, and if you challenge those heifers, they will definitely be at a much smaller weight. You will definitely have a lot more that do not get bred, especially if you're only turning bulls in for 30 days. Now, that's another whole subject we can get off another time. But typically our heifers, when we turn the bulls in, they will weigh from 600 pounds on the light side to 700 on the heavy side at the most, you know, maybe at best, and not many of them up on that heavy end. So how many are actually cycling? Some of those heifers will have not cycled. And so I don't, the plain answer is I don't care. What it is, it is. And I know that in order to truly take advantage of the forages that I grow on my ranch, that's what I need to do to challenge them. The key then becomes in how do you market those that don't get bred so you can get the economic gain from them.
Right.
So I don't, and the ranches we consult on, we don't spend a lot of time worrying about what weight are they at. No, that means I'm going to change my feeding regime or I'm going to supplement to get them to this quote-unquote ideal weight. The whole thought process has to change to one of how do I get animals that thrive under my forages. If I'm supplementing, I'm not going to be doing that. And it'll come back down the road to end up being where, oh, I really don't have cattle that thrive on my forages because I supplement them to get to this quote-unquote optimum weight. The other thing about it is it absolutely amazes me. 26 years in the registered business, I thought I had a decent eye for cattle. I thought I could pick which heifers get bred, etc. Oh, good grief. I couldn't be more further from the truth. You know, it amazes me sometimes what does or does not get bred. And, you know, we've gravitated. Naturally, the cattle have gravitated towards this style of this phenotype of heifers that are, you know, wider muzzled, really big middle, a wide brisket, and just able to consume a lot more because they're consuming lower quality forages. However, once in a while, you'll get an animal that, boy, she looks too tall and too railly, and yet she'll breed and breed every year. Okay, so be it. Bull doesn't mind. He still breeds her, so why should I? You know, why should I? And that's my whole point is let nature do the selection. We just have to put enough pressure on it so it truly is more of that natural selection.
Awesome. One of the questions as we work towards wrapping up here is you said 30 days. Is that your breeding window on the heifers?
That is on the heifers. 30 on the heifers, 45 on the cows. Now, typically, starting out with the clients we consult on, we'd probably recommend at least 45 on the heifers starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we have the heifers right with our cow herd.
Right.
And people, well, how do you do that? Oh, you got a system. Okay, we've been doing this for 12 years. We're calving about 300 head each year. We've lost two females.
Mm-hmm.
One was a 4-year-old cow, and one was a first calf heifer. That's it. And, you know, it amazes me if you just let nature take control, she tends to get things worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. In your first episode, when we had you on to talk about your book, Dirt to Soil, you shared the story about your transition to no-till and cover crops and 4 years of drought and not having enough money to buy twine, so you started bale grazing and some of those awesome things. I really appreciated that. But in this episode, I've caught on to a continued paradigm shift between 1994 and 2008 or so before you went to a later calving season and some of those things. And that was part of that transition was transitioning out of the seed stock business. And now you've also revealed on this episode, not a major news break here, but just you've said it in passing that you're turning out home-raised bulls on the heifers. Are you guys using home-raised bulls on everything?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm not going to say we won't buy a bull. We haven't bought a bull in 5 years. Initially realized I sold balancer bulls, Gelby Angus, Gelby Red Angus Cross. And I thought I was keeping them moderate. Yeah, no, they weren't moderate compared to what we have now. And so initially we did go buy some percentage low-lying bulls. We also bought a few bulls from, I won't name names, but producers who focused on more grass-based genetics, and we added that. But at the same time, we've always, even back when we were in the registered business, we always kept a few of our own bulls. Now it's our bull battery is next to 100%. There's a couple of old bulls in the battery that were purchased. But and how we do this as far as keeping our own bulls, we're still tagging calves. We'd really like to get away from that, but realize when we ship animals to the kill plant, they have to have an ID. Well, it's easier to do it at birth, and we're actually banding any male calves at birth. The reason is it's just easier at that time. We're not as concerned, yes, you know, we could wait, band them later, castrate them later, get a few more pounds of weight, but we're not concerned about weight. We're concerned about profit. They're entirely two different things. And so what my son does, and I leave this up to my son because he's young and he can catch them calves. He goes out to move the cow herd pretty much daily. And so a newborn calf, if it's a bull calf, if it's born from an old cow and that old cow has a good udder, good feet and legs, good disposition, he'll leave it intact, okay? And we do not keep bull calves out of young cows. And the reason being, we want that for proof of fertility. Mm-hmm. We want that longevity. A cow that makes it to age 15 in our herd, she's proven, you know? And we actually have several cows over the age of 20 now in our herd. And they're making us money, you know? They'll come up open, or they'll be cycled through as nutrients on the landscape at some period, you know. So be it. Which, by the way, there's, last time I ran the numbers, there's about $500 worth of NPK and micronutrients in a cow's carcass. So producers need to think of that when they haul these old cows to the sale barn. Maybe that's not the most optimum use for her. Okay.
Yeah, you might not get $500 or $700 for her.
exactly. But so that then what we do, those bull calves they're left right with the cowherd. We wean them in April, and then they get weaned and thrown out with the old bulls. And now come August that first year, we don't turn them out right away. We turn the older bulls out first. Then the last couple weeks of breeding season with the cowherd, we'll dump those young bulls in there just so they get a smell of things, and they really get used harder than as two-year-olds. Mm. But it's simple. It's just simple. And no, not all of them make it. When we wean them at 10 months of age, if we see some obvious ones for one reason or another, we just simply band them then, and, you know, we're not out anything, you know? Now, I know the registered breeders cringe when they hear me talking about producers saving their own bulls. But the fact of the matter is, this is true. Back when I was in the registered business, one of the reasons I got out is I had a lot of longtime customers that were very loyal to me. And it got to the point where I was telling them, don't buy bulls from me anymore. Keep your own. You're raising for your environment better genetics than I can provide you. And there's truth to that. They're acclimated to the environment. And if we truly want to be profitable in this beef business at today's market prices, we need to think of things like that.
Very good. So Wally Olson asks a question, and when Wally Olson asks a question, I ask it. So he says he's been trying to figure out the numbers on it takes 5 to 7 years to pay for a cow, and he's wondering if you have any thoughts on that or if you know where those numbers came from.
Yeah, I would say on our ranch, I know for a fact it doesn't take that long. If you were to purchase the animal, and again, it depends on how high your feed cost is. I think Wally Olson, I think the world of them. I think in the right scenarios, the buy-sell, bringing animals in, I think it's absolutely fantastic, and I encourage producers to look at that if they want to be in that type of a model. In our model of selling meat direct market, you know, I can't go just buy any genetics and get the quality of the product that I need to satisfy customers. As far as the 5 to 7 years to pay for a cow, it's not anywhere close to that on our ranch, but I can certainly see where it would be on most ranches today.
Yep. Last question, and then I want to give you an opportunity to share some of the things that you've got going on, is what is the hard numbers, if you know them, or as close as you can get on 2 and 3 year old breed up and some of those things in this model for you guys?
Oh, sure. In our model, 2 and 3 year old breed up is from 86 to 90%. Breed up on the older cow herd is probably 87 to that 92%, somewhere in there. So as I said, once we get them bred as heifers, they're going to stay in our herd. And realize even the ones that don't, it absolutely does not matter to us because, well, case in point, our net profit last year, I'm talking 2018, we haven't ran all the numbers on 2019 yet, per beef animal killed was $1,696. That's net profit per beef animal killed. So if she comes up open, she's still profitable. Yeah. You know, we make more money on our open heifers than we do selling them as bred heifers. You know, initially, you know, right. Now long term, if you keep them, it'd be a bit different.
But, sure.
Yeah.
Gabe, I really appreciate your time today. I would love to give you an opportunity to share some things you've got going on with Soil Health Academy or anywhere else that you might be in the near future that you want to share. This will be out first part of January of 2020. So.
Well, I appreciate that. It's a real pleasure to be with you, Claire. I always enjoy visiting with you. And I just want to say that I hope you realize the number of people that this podcast is reaching. As I travel and here it's the last day of the year, I've been on the road 282 days this year. 242 flights. That's a lot of airplanes in and out of. But it amazes me as I travel. This is one of the podcasts that producers are really gravitating to. And so I commend you for that. Now, some of the things we got going on, my business partners and I with Soil Academy and Understanding Ag, it's a bit mind-blowing what we're seeing out there. You know, there's a real crisis out there in production agriculture right now. I had the opportunity to visit with a few higher-ups in the credit industry. And in certain parts of the country, as much as one-third of the farm and ranch borrowers are in financial difficulties. You know, we're seeing suicide rates the highest ever in farming and ranching, and that's really, really concerning. So I really encourage producers to take a look at changing the way they see things and look at things a bit differently. I also want to mention we're doing some exciting work right now with nutrient density of products. Our firm was hired to do some comparisons on nutrient density of different grains and vegetables, and we started down the path in meat of those products that were grown or raised on quote-unquote regenerative farms and ranches. Alongside a neighboring farmer ranch that was using conventional practices. And we've documented this on 17 pair of farms or ranches. So in other words, you know, for instance, one was mine and one was a neighboring farm. And there were 17 of those pairs scattered throughout North America. The initial data that we're getting back, and we're doing whole nutrient analysis. For instance, on the beef, it's all fatty acid profiles, et cetera. The difference is even more amazing or astounding than we thought it would be. And so the ability for consumers to measure this nutrient density is quickly coming to fruition. I really think within 5 years, it'll be on every iPhone, where you'll have an app on your iPhone. You'll be able to go scan a fruit, a vegetable, a cut of meat in a grocery store, and it will read nutrient density. And once it does that, that's going to drive whole change to production agriculture, because it's going to measure the type of things that you're not going to be able to, quote unquote, cheat or influence in the processing of that product. And so we're really excited about that. I will just tell you, and I throw this out there just as a comparison, you know, take omega-6s to omega-3s. The average of grain-fed beef is approximately 9-to-1. If that finished beef animal was fed distiller's grain, it's 55-to-1 or higher. Okay. The beef that we tested on our ranch, we have an omega-6 to omega-3 of 1.3-to-1. Okay, look at the difference there. Now, think of consumers consuming that over their lifetime. What difference does that make in human health, et cetera? These are the kinds of things that are coming down the pipe that ranchers, farmers really need to be aware of, because it's going to directly affect their pocketbook. So I challenge them, you know, where do you want to be? You know, do you want to build resilience into your operation and make sure that you can meet those demands that consumers are going to place on you? Look at it as a challenge and look at it as a good thing, because by moving down this path, you will put more dollars in your pocket.
It's the difference between that heifer that you selected with your eye and the heifer that nature selected with with her ability. You look at that bell pepper on the shelf and it looks really good, but then you scan it and you know the nutrient density and you're like, maybe not as much as I thought.
Yeah, you know it came from Denmark. Figure that out. How fresh can that be coming from Denmark, right?
Gabe, thanks for your kind words, and I really appreciate your time today, and I will put some links in the show notes page to the Soil Health Academy school, upcoming schools that you've got. There are a lot of them coming up, so opportunities for everybody to get involved with that. If there's anything else you want me to share in the show notes page at workingcows.net/121, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Clay. Pleasure to be with you today.
It was good to have Gabe on the Working Cows podcast, and look forward to next week's episode. We are going to be talking with Josh Dukart, who is a holistic management educator from actually Gabe's neighborhood there near Bismarck, North Dakota. So really excited to talk to him about letting nature do some of the work for us and how we can be more intentional about finding ways to let nature go to work for us. So if you ever want to submit questions to guests that we have here on the Working Cows podcast, we do give quite a bit of opportunity to do that through the private Facebook group, which you can join by going to patreon.com/workingcows, and you can join the private Facebook group for $1 a month, or you can join and get bonus episodes released periodically for $5 a month. And we've got quite a few supporters, even at $20 a month, who are getting some gifts sent to them on about Christmas time every year. So I just sent those out, but I've got gifts kind of in store that I can send out to new people who join. And then yearly after that, around Christmas time, I'll be sending out other gifts. So if you join now, you'll be in line to get a fairly nice gift, if I do say so myself, around Christmas time. But thanks for all the support in other ways. Had a lot of real nice gifts sent to me over the Christmas season from the Amazon wish list, and I really appreciate that. Some of that's going to go a long ways to helping with some more high-quality recordings when I go to the Holistic Management Canada annual convention in Camrose, Alberta. If you want to be there, there will be some information there in the show notes page as well at workingcows.net/121, workingcows.net/121. Check that out, and we'll see you next week with Josh Dukart on the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. for more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.